Welcome back to Cambridge Inside Out. I'm still Robert Winters, and he's...
Judy Barrett.
No, he's, no.
No, I'm Patrick. I'm still Patrick. I'm
still always Patrick. Yeah, Patrick. So we spent a bunch of time over the last hour talking about Central Square, the greatest place on earth.
Yes.
There are a few other kind of major things that are, you know, either zoning-related things or whatever.
Not Starlight Square?
Starlight Square. That's right. Central...
You know, actually, maybe coming to a sign.
You know, there are places like in New York City. I think it's 6th Avenue is also called Avenue of the Americas. I could have that wrong. There's other places where it's such and such avenue. It says Avenue of the Arts.
Are you saying a place could have another name at the same time?
Just like the Mystic Tobin Bridge.
My goodness.
Or the Bunker Hill Zeca Memorial Bridge.
What an age in which we live.
Right. It's incredible. So, you know, if we could say we can say Central / Starlight Square.
Central Square. I'm passing through Starlight into Central.
There you go. I like it. So, anyway. So, one of the things, you know, just zoning is boring. Let's be clear, right?
Yep.
Zoning. Patrick writes it. He knows how boring it can be.
I do.
But one of the things that's coming up, you know, it's now into the actual ordinance committee phase is the so-called, I always get this wrong, it's 100% affordable housing overlay proposal. I never understood why it's called an overlay.
Well,
because if it's something citywide,
I
guess.
It's semantic, but it's called, because it overrides the existing zoning in all the districts of the city. So,
I see.
In a sense, it is an overlay.
Okay. So it's more like an override then.
Oh, no, yeah.
Okay, all right. So anyway, that, you know, I think from the original proposals or ideas that were floated, there were a few tweaks here and there. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, right now, at least I think I actually heard Iram Faruqa, the Community Development Department, at a meeting the other day, basically say that, well, it is what it is right now. We're not really in any mood to be changing anything. So the council just sort of asked. Obviously, the council can amend, but basically they've put what they want out on the table. And
it hasn't changed substantially. I mean, there's nothing there that's dramatic.
So I think it's got a planning board hearing on June 25th, which I guess is next Tuesday. And then the following week, it's going to be a City Council Ordinance Committee, I think on July 2nd.
My favorite part of this entire saga was at the very beginning when CDD gave the recommendations to the planning board and they were sort of unveiling the overlay scheme.
Right.
The entire planning board looked at CDD, I think it was Aram giving the presentation, like she had 20 heads. So like, what are you talking? Really? What?
Yeah.
It was a shock. And if you read the minutes of that, they're like, this, I just don't believe that you're doing this.
Yeah, I actually was there for part of that meeting, and most of the planning board members, I mean, I think there were one or two members of the planning board who are kind of politically driven toward promoting subsidized or affordable housing at any cost, anywhere, anytime. Yeah. So, but most of the members of the planning board were very skeptical, especially of the provisions that, you know, that said that there would be no right to, no room for discussion for people.
Well, it removes the planning board's, the planning board's in an advisory position in terms of the overlay now. So if you're a resident and you don't like, you want to basically assert your rights as an abutter, you have no rights. You basically, this turns every affordable project into a by right project.
Right.
Which, it's one of those things where like, when I built my house, I had people show up in protest of me building my home. They, it was nerve wracking. It was a total pain in the butt. And they weren't even direct abutters. And it's just a process that us regular folk have to go through. And it was for my home, so it added another layer of, anxiety on top of the fact that I had a son plus a daughter on the way and a family to put into a home. And, it's one of those cases where I think, a bad law is coming out of a bunch of bad behavior because people in the city have pushed it too damn far. They have showed up to protest everything from a sign being hung to, a basement apartment being built or a deck being built or a window to the point where now we're saying, screw it, you have no say. And that's what the affordable developers want. I mean, that's what every developer would dream for. It's why if you read the list of things that the affordable overlay allows, it's almost like, diving into the id of a developer saying, oh gosh, what could you possibly want for Christmas? But I can understand why there's frustration because people go too far here. They've asserted their rights to the point where the only answer that the other groups are coming up with now is you have no rights. which to me is just a bad result.
Right. So you're basically responding to one set of bad behavior with another set of bad behavior.
It's when I did a little constitutional law up at the Cambridge University in Latin, teaching some kids about the Bill of Rights, we went over some case law regarding search and seizures. And there's different laws in the school. We won't get into it, but like the point is that some of those laws came about because some people were just jerks, and they pushed it too far. And they pushed it so far with such egregious behavior that it wound up in the Supreme Court, and now your rights are getting stripped away. Right. And I think in a similar situation, that's where we are here. That the people who want to do, you know, the Lord's work of building affordable housing, which I won't even get into that, you know, they're being obstructed to some degree, just like everyone else is. The same people who showed up to stop my home from being built are the same people who are stopping this kind of development from being built. You know, you can go to the planning board or the BZA any given night, and you'll see the same people.
One of the things that I think I've been pretty clear that I'm not a fan of this proposal. But one of the things that especially bothered me was I basically said, listen, if you believe that the city can support more density, then maybe what you should do is just look what the prevailing densities are in particular neighborhoods, mm-hmm. and just adjust the zoning just to say, okay, well, that's what's there, so let's just make that the rule, and we should make a lot more properties either conforming or closer to conforming, mm-hmm. where they would be a much easier process if they needed to do a little bit of a variance or whatever. But the thing is the decision was made, I think, very, very consciously to actually keep that as restrictive as possible, so that in fact it was just, you know, so that in fact it would create an advantage for some of the so-called affordable housing developers to come in and be able to basically say, oh, you can't do that? Well, I can.
Yeah. Well, in the same way, the people
that's kind of insulting.
who downzoned the crap out of the city to the point where we're like 80% non-conforming. Non-conformance was the point of all of that.
Yes.
It was to stop everybody from doing everything. And again, we went too damn far.
You know, actually, I'm not going to say all, but a lot of that downzoning fervor was something that sort of was a product of the mid-90s, as late as 2000. I think there was a big change.
2001.
Yeah, but there was a bit of a change around then to sort of promote housing growth because it was like sort of the post-rent control mindset changing.
In the mind of the council and CUD to promote housing, they just penalized commercial. That was how they decided they were going to promote housing.
Well,
they didn't increase the housing build. They just penalized commercial.
They penalized commercial, but also allowed housing to be built in commercial zones where it previously was not. So that's a change in the allowed uses.
Apparently no one at the time had a calculator, because even at a 2.75 FAR for commercial build, I'm still outpacing a residential value by almost like four times. Right. If you look at, I had a little zoning amendment for the Industry B a few months ago, and I showed a map from 2001 when they downzoned the crap out of the city, including getting rid of most of these industry areas, except for this one zone, the net effect of penalizing commercial development. The net effect was that in the entire district, that IB district, they built six more non-conforming commercial structures. Not a single home had been built.
Right.
The only person who brought a housing project there, and it was done in 2011, was sued by the abutter and gave up.
Right, right. So maybe we're not doing everything so right, you know, but the thing is, I don't think the proposal that's before the city council now is doing things right either.
They're passing the buck. I've claimed on Twitter that I am like a Jane Goodall amongst liberals. I don't understand this ballet that we're doing where we,
you know. I will agree that you are surrounded by monkeys.
It's crazy. The overlay makes everyone feel good because affordable housing is something you say, that's great.
Actually, it was something interesting that Vice Mayor Devereaux said at City Council meeting yesterday. Because I think she's sort of being boxed into a corner, because my sense is that she's got some questions about this proposal. Yet every time she tries to express it, she starts getting whelped on by some councilors who are trying to basically communicate this brutal message that anybody who has questions is somehow opposed to affordability in housing.
Well, because Janice has a history of being at the planning board and showing up to protest projects, you know, is being anti-devs, where, you know, I think actually it's so sad to see her leave because I really do have enjoyed her as a counselor.
I actually agree.
She reads strongly. We don't agree on a lot of stuff. We didn't agree on trees. We don't agree on development.
She takes her job seriously.
Yeah, I have great respect for her. Yeah. But you know, the overlay, I think, is doing this sort of ballet where they feel good about this affordable housing. They feel good about building only 100%. And that's something I've heard from CDD, that the council has given them a mandate that the inclusionary ordinance that we have, the 80-20 split between market rate and affordable housing, is not enough and does not warrant any further investigation in terms of whether we can expand it or allow for larger bills, because they only want to promote 100% affordable housing.
It's amazing to me the degree to which there's been this I don't know how it came to be shifted, this notion that somehow having a more of a mix of incomes in housing is actually the good thing that we should be aspiring to.
That's what my mom always told me.
So that's why inclusionary zoning, when it was originally pitched in the late 1990s and improved upon, we'll see what actually gets built, but within the last couple of years.
Are you talking about the expansion?
Yeah, well, basically, when they bumped it up from 15 nominal up to 20%
absolute. We'll see what that actually does.
We'll see what it absolutely does. But the thing is that I'm not going to in any way question their intention, because it would be kind of nice if you get that good mix of incomes in housing generally. Don't we all wish?
Well, the mix of income is something that just, from every urbanist, any planner that I've ever read or I've heard, has told me this is the way to go. And I just feel, and I think it instinctively feels like that's how we should be building our cities.
I actually feel that in many respects that the overlay is almost saying like, well, sorry, we made a mistake. We didn't actually believe what we said when we were passing inclusionary zoning, because what we really want to do is to basically just have the 100% subsidized housing as sort of standalones. And I don't know that I think that that's a good idea.
I absolutely agree. And if you're a pragmatist like me, there's another little miracle about inclusionary housing that doesn't often get much play. And is that this is developer-built affordable housing, that developer-maintained affordable housing, so that the taxpayers and federal funding and state funding and all those little avenues of funding that always dry up, there's never enough of,
and which we're also not dependent on. And also restrict who you can rent to because of the way the funding works.
That's a whole other dimension of this argument that really just bakes my bread in terms of who's showing up at these meetings with the stickers on saying, I need affordable housing now. I feel like there's I've noticed this ritual amongst the council where, you know, in these kinds of contentious debates where people are just lied to.
I think this is really kind of at least part of the motivation with Vice Mayor Devereaux said when she says this process, this is to debate a particular proposal. It is not, should not be viewed as a referendum on affordable housing.
But that's what it is.
Well, the thing is some of the more aggressive proponents of it are casting it as saying, you either do what we say you must do without change, or you're opposed to the affordability of housing.
Yeah. And affordability for who? Because the middle class is the group of people that are getting kicked out of this city, and this is not for them.
And the Envision Cambridge process made it really, really clear that in terms of the lower income strata, that's been relatively constant throughout. Mm-hmm. The real caving in really had to do with the middle income people.
Yeah, I mean, as a population, the lower income stays pretty consistent, and it's the rich a-holes who have gone through the roof, because, again, $1,000 a square foot on Pearl Street, those houses get sold. It blows my mind.
Right.
But, you know, that's...
There's, by the way, now I'm going to sound a little mathy or anything, but, you know, the notion that somehow you can have an accelerating appreciation in real estate value forevermore is kind of absurd.
Yes.
You know, the thing is that if anything, that leads to a bust at some point. I think would happen more in a Cambridge context, and I'm just speaking kind of anecdotally now, but it was that inevitably has to level.
It may even be
doing so now, but anybody can point to some examples where it appears not to be. But
well, everyone loves to throw antidote into it. And when you look at the rental rates, they're always touted as like, you know, it's $1 million for a one bed and infinity $1 billion for two. What they're talking about are the actual new buildings that are being built.
Right.
In terms of what they're trying to market them as, to reach pro forma, to make a bunch of make a boardroom happy. If you're talking about a guy who owns a two-family in North Cambridge, he's not renting his two-bedroom out for an infinity $1 billion.
Right.
He's probably either 50 to 60% of what the market actually is.
And chances are the CDD people in the housing division have never got data about it because they don't really talk about how much
rent they get. And thanks to numbnuts like Mike Connolly, you know, that guy in North Cambridge who has a two-family is probably the only thing he owns on this earth, right, and is now going to start jacking the crap out of his rents because he's terrified the rent control is coming back.
Right.
Thanks,
that's,
Mike.
Right. That's actually one of the great fears. The thing is that, you know, if, I mean, you know, if I happen to own rental property, I have two apartments for rent. And the thing is that if I actually had a really strong belief that, in fact, within 6 months, they were going to basically cap me at no more than a 2% increase forevermore, then I would probably want to set my initial rents as high as I can, even if I wasn't intending to ever raise them, just to sort of preserve my options.
Instead of having an adult conversation about housing and development, the same people who block development throughout the city are the same people now suggesting that we reverse the clocks, go back in time, and do it all over again. I don't know anybody who is part of that fight, and I mean it on both sides, who wants to do this again.
Right.
And that, you know, for the, I can only imagine is to again, I'm just observing this behavior, but maybe it's to get votes, maybe it's to get stay in office forever. You know, people talk about housing as a right. Okay, maybe it's a right, like I have a right to an attorney. I have a right to an attorney, but I don't have a right to a specific attorney. But if you
take, I don't have a right to live on Brattle Street.
Right, I have a right to a house, but I don't have a right to your house.
Be nice.
But I think you took that. Their rhetoric to their natural conclusion. I think if, you know, if a guy like Mike had the ability to give my house to somebody, he'd
give your house to somebody.
He would. Yeah. There's no end. Right. There's no sating that desire of control.
Yeah, I mean that's sort of the extreme case of somebody who sort of is a kind of a philosophical left of Leninist type of person. But the thing is that as I look around now, because this is a municipal election year, and I'm a voter. Right. I mean, I don't mouth off so much about who I'm voting for generally. But the thing is that I'm looking around at candidates. I'm looking at incumbents. I'm looking at some of the new candidates. And I'm getting such mixed messages from people. I'm seeing people who at least basically respect the notion that there may be that increasing the supply of housing is a sort of a generally a good thing, you know, especially if it's done with some intelligence. Mm-hmm. But then they, at the same time, in order to appeal to a certain narrow constituency, then they sort of say, oh yeah, and by the way, we have to start come down hard on those evil landlords. And I say, what? Don't give me a mixed message. Give me a consistent message.
Well, they're talking about tenant protections, and there's some degree of logic to their argument. It sounds good inherently. It sounds like, yeah, we do need that. We do need more protection. We do need more affordable housing. They don't talk about sort of the mechanics of it all. And I think if you look at where Somerville has adopted a very strenuous regulation for condo conversion, and Cambridge is looking to do exactly the same thing. If you look at how many condos are being converted in Cambridge, I think last year it was like 80.
Well, the thing is,
it's the wrong fight.
It is the wrong fight because that ship sailed so long ago. You know, I kind of was of the belief that doing some sort of restrictions on condo conversion might have been a good thing in 1998.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, and in fact, if you look in when the city comes out with the assessments and things, you know, for setting the real estate tax rates, they put information, and I've got them all going back into the early 1990s. And what you can see is that back then, you know, if you looked at the breakout of like how many how many big buildings, how many triple deckers, two families, one families, condo units, right, and the breakout, condos were like actually pretty small, the lowest on the list. And then, you know, since then, virtually every triple decker except mine, you know, has been turned into condos, so that now the condos, which was at the bottom of the list in terms of number of units, is at the top of the list.
Right.
Completely upside down now. So that ship has sailed.
And they're going after larger parcels, which I think maybe instinctively feels right to them. But if you do this for a living, and I do, we're not building 10 large buildings to sell them off as condos. You know, there might be a time, and right now the economy is a little bit wonky, but I can't see it in the next 10 years where that changes. That you get anecdotes, like there was one, a building in Somerville that she converted 100 units of housing to condominiums. It's not an epidemic of proportion, although it's treated like that by Connolly. But talking, I'm on the Sumble's Blue Ribbon Committee for Tenant Advocacy, and I'm the evil landlord ballast for the group. You know, there's, you know, there's a lot of mixed understanding of what actually is taking place. And, and a lot of it, there's a lot of attorneys on there who've done tenant advocacy, and I've done that too. When I was a young attorney, I did a lot of tenant advocacy. Young attorney, I became an attorney at 36, so like from 36 to 37.
It's a lifetime.
Right? There is some there's some legs to that, but also it doesn't solve the bigger problem, which is you need more housing.
Right.
And you need to incentivize to build more housing. And if you're talking about bringing down the draconian regulations of rent control, you're gonna wind up in the same cycle that we've just been in. We got out of rent control in the early aughts. The values are jumping back up, but that was suppressed value. Right. And you're gonna do it all over again. Who won the most during rent control? MIT and Harvard. They bought up a ton of property because it was cheap. There's a bunch of guys who are still around here who've done residential. They bought it cheap.
That's what they did.
Guys like me will stay in here, and you bring back rent control, I'll buy cheap. And so you guys come back to your senses, and then all of a sudden, I'm not just taking money baths. I've added some gemstones. I've plated my dog in gold. Like, it's just nonsense. But all to avoid the pragmatic truth, which there's no economist on the planet who disagrees with this, that you need to build more housing.
Now, there's a fellow from North Cambridge, Mike Nakagawa. So today I actually read a very interesting thing he did on a Nextdoor posting. I think one of the other neighborhood groups now has already grabbed hold of it and is reposting it, whatever. But he gave, I thought it was actually a pretty scholarly thing about supply and demand, but he made a good point how the laws of supply and the laws of demand, they're not, you can't think of these things as just a twofer.
Right.
One goes up, one goes down. There's all these other factors. And he made a really, really coherent argument. I really like that. But the truth is that adding a supply of housing, yes, if you're also adding a lot of really high-end jobs to drive the demand, then you can add a lot of supply, and it's not going to have a hell of a lot of effect on costs, right? But the thing is that this is one of the things I said during the Envision Cambridge meeting many times over, but then again, I was ignored, is that I made the point that if they built 600 or 1,000 units of housing in Union Square, Somerville, that would have a greater effect on affordability of housing in Cambridge than virtually anything else that anybody else was proposing.
Are you suggesting it's a regional issue?
I am suggesting it is a regional issue, yet the Envision Cambridge, even though we gave it a lot of lip service early how important that was, we never talked regionally. Never.
How is that even possible? I think anybody,
right.
And
I'll say, just to blather on a little more, when I go through along pieces of Watertown and I see that places where out where the old Hood River factory used to be and where there were just empty lots or big parking lots that served other interests over the years that are now becoming housing and a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And then I talk to somebody and say, oh, where are you living now? Oh, I got a place out in Watertown.
Yeah.
I'm really looking at it and saying to myself, okay, there are people who are actually exercising options and going not very far away from Cambridge and actually finding housing. I don't know what the rents are. I don't know how good or bad or whatever it is. But the truth is that you need to have that sort of thing happening all around Cambridge in order to have a good effect for Cambridge. And it's obvious.
It's impossible disagreeing that even us ranting about it is non-conclusive. But if you look at any urban planner or any data that suggests, it also says the same thing.
Yeah.
So it's not a conspiracy, but also if we're relying on anecdote, you hear stories from people who are really anti-development saying, well, we built 800 units of housing last year, and it's still expensive to live here. And you're like, what are you talking about?
There is a kind of a mindset, I think, among selected officials, which is that we have to do something.
Yeah.
And they look to things that they say, what can we control? What can we control? But a lot of times it's this instinct to control is in fact the wrong way to think about things. So the thing is like even with this overlay proposal, what are they doing? They're basically saying we're gonna crunch down on the ability for ordinary property owners to do things or keep it as capped as it is today, but then we're gonna allow only preferred developers to go do things, and this way we can control the output.
Right.
But it's very much a command and control, almost a military kind of mindset about how you get good outcomes. Is you put an iron fist on it, and then that's the only way we're going to actually.
But output that's 100% reliant on federal and state funding. It's almost. It's a good real life example of this is, and sorry, Mike, but I'm going to beat you up again. Your courthouse battle. You're talking about all these people talking about reclaiming the courthouse, saying we're going to turn it into public housing. Are you effing serious?
The absurdity of saying that we want to turn the Sullivan Courthouse into 100% affordable housing, when in fact you then, in the next breath, have to acknowledge that the cost per unit is what? What would it be?
A little over a million.
Little over a million per unit. I mean, this is perhaps the single stupidest contradiction I think I've ever heard.
Well, it's the last stab from a group of people who really wanted that place to be a park.
Right. It's true. And listen, if I was born and raised there, maybe I might have that inclination, but I think it's not particularly realistic. By the way, tomorrow night, there's a meeting, a city-sponsored meeting on the disposition, or at least a public informational meeting, I'm not exactly sure, about the First Street garage, because I think...
The report's out.
There is a report that came out that pretty much said, look, this makes sense to actually do a leasehold arrangement for...
Obviously, it's a conspiracy, units. Robert. Of course. The good people at the traffic and parking department are like, you know...
But the thing is, it's not just the parking spaces. It's also, I think, what is it? Was it something like 9,000 square feet of retail frontage on First Street that would also be then available for actually doing really good things that people who live there are going to appreciate? You know, so I'm not sort of shilling for Leggett McCall here, for goodness sake. But the thing is that take a look, just look at it in the cold light of day and say, this is ultimately...
Imagine you're a resident in East Cambridge, or just in, you know, Central Square or wherever you goes to East Cambridge, and like have to be held hostage for as long as they have been with this no outcome. Is ridiculous. I mean, there are people outside my building right now waiting to get back into Toscanini's, and I apologize to each and every one of them. But you've only had to wait about a year and a half.
Yeah.
People in the courthouse have been waiting for, like, what, 7 years?
Oh, much longer than that.
Right.
So I say make that happen, but then put you East Cambridge folks, you good folks in East Cambridge, put your attention over to Leachmere. You know, when they move the Green Line, there's some really great things you can help make happen. So go make it happen.
Go make it happen.
Make it happen. So anyway, we're out of here on Cambridge Inside Out.